earlier precedents. So if you take a snapshot of what's happening now, I think it gives you a distorted image of the relationship of leadership to media.
That's a good point. Yes, I'm sure that's right. And the other thing I've observed in my own country is just how sycophantic the media habitually is towards any new way in the modern world. Because obviously the leader has certain things that he can trade, doesn't he? I mean, he has access he can trade. He has, in our system, he has information that he can trade. In other words, it can be an implicit part of the bargain that, look, by application, you give me decent treatment and you portray me in a reasonable way, and I will keep feeding you the goodies, as you were, and the nuggets of information that you need to be an effective media man.
Yeah, but in American politics, for the last 20 years, the incentives for the media have been on the other side. Even though there's something that the president can give the people in the media, what's led to the success of careers in the media has been the fact that they have undermined the official authority. And the worst sin of any American journalist in the post-Watergate age and Vietnam age would be to appear to be have been taken in by public authority. So the dominant model for 20 years was adversarial. And the ones who made out best were the ones who sort of got something on the president. And that was probably because there's so many career elements within the press itself that reward those who are against in an adversarial posture that more than makes up for what the official sources can give to the people in the media. Well, I would say, at least in American politics, the danger in the last 20 years has not been sycophancy, but the opposite, sort of carping negativism. Now, that may be changing now, but really, I think, during the Carter years, early Reagan years, that was the distinguishing feature. Because, after all, what they're interested in most, these journalists, is their own careers. And their careers are, I think, rewarded according to how they come off among people in the media. Pulitzer Prizes.
Jim, please come, if you can spare the time.
But I had another.
Right, because we had a...
Am I taking your...
No? We had a point, didn't we, where it wasn't clear that it was just terminology that was separating us, or whether there was a real difference of view in the view you take about the impact of this media context in which we now are upon political leadership, and that's the view I take. Would you like to just elaborate what you were getting at?
You know, as you probably know, there have been several sort of leading theories about the impact of the media on presidential leadership in the United States. And they have varied partially, I suppose, with the leader who's in office. But one of the prominently featured theories has been that the rise of the television media and thought of as the rise of the mass electronic media is a dangerous development in power terms, because it has given an extraordinary advantage to the presidency as against other elites, and particularly as against Congress. So this was early, this was sort of early on in the development of mass media. I don't think that's any longer the leading hypothesis, is it, Jim?
No, that there's an independent elite of the media that is great.
That there's now, some say it's the independent elite, which I think is, you've got to take account of. Others are beginning to think that perhaps it's a positive disadvantage, in part because it has created a whole new apparatus of media elites who not only in the press but elsewhere, makes it harder for the president to monopolize public attention, and during waves of skepticism creates powerful organs of opinion formation to do the president in and rob him of public confidence, deservedly or not. So I think currently if we're sort of moving toward the other theory,
And maybe something in that, because after all, again, in my country, to give you an example from there, leaders in office, on the whole, don't like to give equal TV time to their opponents, to their sort of regular opponents. And the ground, and the reason for that is, basically, that you destroy the sort of the mystery and the special quality that, that your office or your position has if you give equal time to the other man. So the audience, even though the audience is told that this person speaking now is the Prime Minister and this person is just the leader of the opposition or something, in fact, in their minds, because they're at the same podium, speaking for the same length of time in the same way and all that, you know, they're going to give them equal credibility, as it were, at least until they prove to the contrary. So that suggests that that actually the more sources of view that are on offer through this medium, the more, as you said, Jim, it's going to detract from the sort of the authority, if you like, of the top person.
I don't know. It's not a question simply of equal time. It's a question of people who make a profession of as opinion leaders.
Mm.
And so you get the phenomenon of the president appearing on television and then with a major speech, provided it's timed right.
Yeah.
And you know, they no longer snap their fingers and the media decide to give it national coverage.
Mm.
That day has passed. And then you find Washington opinion leaders around the table, one or more, say, what, telling the public what the president has just said, what it means, and how it should be interpreted.
Mm.
And that goes on daily, whether the president's giving a public speech or not.
Mm.
It's that layer of a media, independently of the government, explaining what's going on in Washington, what the president's word is worth, or what's really behind what he's doing, or things of this kind. It's not the question of the opposition or opponents getting equal time.
Mm.
It's this layer of new intermediaries.
Sure.
It's not the party people, it's the media people who are performing this role.
So they have become the new intermediaries, as you say, haven't they?
It's a very big industry in this
country. That's right. Because in the old-fashioned sense, it was the parties and the interest groups who were both the megaphones or the filters, depending on what was required, of the message from on high. Whereas now what you're saying is that there's a whole new class, as it were, of these people who are professional intermediaries, purveyors of information, distorters of information, interpreters of information. And if the public is dependent on them, in the same way that in small-town America, sort of 50 years ago or 100 years ago, they were dependent upon the local party representative or the local interest group representative, as they might have been. It gives these people a lot of power, that's what you're saying, isn't it?
Not only power, but they. I think that one of the interesting studies is to ask, how do they filter and interpret events as distinct from or in comparison with the people who used to be the intermediary?
Mm.
Because when you do it for the purpose of making of reporting news, you bring to bear on that process of interpretation a very different set of, I won't say biases, but perspective than someone who does it who's a party official.
Mm.
They're presenting new information and interpreting it for certain ends or reasons, namely for the objectives of a party.
Mm.
Whereas these people are doing it for another end set of ends and objectives, which is to make news and to produce news. And therefore, I think the interesting, one of the interesting kind of studies is to ask the question, what is it that is involved in trying to make and interpret news? Because news is one way of seeing reality that's different from, let's say, social science interpretation of reality or party officials' interpretation of reality. And it brings with it certain perspectives. And I think some people have now been trying to look at it and see what is the news view of reality and how do they interpret events and why?
Mm.
And how does that differ from past days?
That's right, the Glasgow group have done that for one, haven't they? I've read some of their stuff in Britain. And they say, well...
Excuse me, I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, please, I've made the point of it.
The other big issue about which there's now a lot of theorizing and concern concerning the media is not only to how it affects the president's capacity to lead once in office or affect his situation, because the media have become another branch of government, something we used to recognize years ago before propaganda to the controversy, to the office. The other thing is, has it had an effect, if so, what effect, on who gets elected? There's the effect on the selection process, not only for presidents, but for members of Congress, to the extent that the party no longer plays the kind of important role in forwarding candidates or in, even in selecting among competing candidates. The media have come to play an important role, as generally recognized, in the nomination and selection process, and have some distortions occurred there. Is a change for the better or for the worse? That I think those are the two main kinds of issues and areas of theorizing about media roles and politics that are going on. There's a growing but still small number of people in my discipline who are beginning to study quite methodically the impact of media on the conduct of policy.
What about, is there a third group? You mentioned it several times, this amplifier idea. Is there anything new about the fact that Sunday before last, for instance, Jack Kilpatrick, in one of the talk shows, mentioned that he had just, along with three or four other people, maybe he said just one or two, I can't remember, had a long session with Jack Kemp, and he set forth Kemp's view, the authentic views of Jack Kemp, in a much more sympathetic way than the other people on this panel were giving. George Will actually participated in the writing, didn't he? Wasn't it the first inaugural? He at least was very heavily involved in Reagan's formulation of his first major statement, I think.
Also coached him on his TV debate.
And coached, So although George Will from time to time does criticize certain Reagan policies, he's been in it, and on certain policies, you get, well, Krauthammer, for instance, has gone much further, for instance, on broadcast than Reagan himself does, in articulating the Reagan doctrine, really has made a career out of that. Is there anything new in that, or is this more or less what Reston has done for years when he'd have a column?
Lippmann did it for a while, I know that.
Lippmann
did it with Kennedy.
But not on television, did he?
I don't know.
Partly because he was no good in television. I don't know if you ever heard him speak.
I never saw him.
But I did see him several times. He'd read anything he had to deliver, and in a monotone, and he disliked that so much.
Well, these people are good at it. It's the equivalent, the moral equivalent, in my view, of being paid by the party in power, journalism for hire. And this is an old tradition in the United States before we had a free press.
But on your point earlier, Jim, about whether it affects the kind of people who get elected, I mean, I'd make perhaps the trite observation that it seems, on the evidence, to affect people who get elected in this country a great deal more than in some of the other countries I might study, for reasons which will be familiar to you. But then the second point is a sort of general caveat or general health warning, which is that you can look at almost any profession or any walk of life if you like, and you'll find that those who aspire to get on, to climb the ladder, have got to conform on the whole, whether it's explicit or implicit, to certain requirements. I mean, if you go and work for IBM, something I happen to know a little bit about from observation, you're expected to dress in a certain way. You're expected to follow the company mores and, you know, that they're sort of rules of engagement, as it were. You're expected to show the company's sense of humour. I mean, the whole thing is kind of patterned. It's almost cradle to grave. And so just as you would never really get on as a kind of an outsider, as a bit of grit in the oyster in an organisation like that, so the same would be true of a political party. A degree of conformity is required. So the same would be true of the media, because, I mean, if you go, I've been on a few media shows, I mean, not the big stuff, but, you know, the minor stuff. And if you don't play the game, obviously, if it's going out live, you've got them in the sense that you can do it once. But you can bet your bottom dollar that your card will be marked, because they all have these things called 3x5 cards, and they won't invite you again, because you didn't play the game. So if you're at all sensitive to these things, you know that your ticket to get back on again and to have the same sort of exposure, particularly when you're in the role of demandeur, in other words, when you need the exposure more than they need you, is that you've got to play it by the rules, even if the rules aren't put up on some wall somewhere, you know, where it says rule number one, you must do this, rule number two, you must not do that. You just almost by a sort of sixth sense get to know the terms and conditions on which you can make use of these techniques.
I wonder, though, if everybody responds to appearances, how much the effect is. That was in part behind my question, because the list of presidents, for example, it would be hard, just judging their proficiency in the media, which is basically an entertainment medium. It would be hard to say that the system rewards those who are proficient at the meeting. You could make some cases, but you couldn't make that as a generalization. There have been too many presidents who've been successful, and even in getting elected, who were terrible on the meeting.
Sure.
Harry Truman had one saving grace, and that is he got feisty on television. Eisenhower, you know, was terrible at just about everything he did on the last week. And yet he's one of the few presidents of modern times whose popularity measured in gross terms, is the grossest kind of thing, increased the longer he was in office. He was the first president to Ronald Reagan that had ever happened since this thing had been measured, and it had nothing to do. So he was rewarded, re-elected, for qualities that were associated with very poor. Dick Neustadt makes the point that Kennedy was the television star, and he sort of become the
model, the standard.
Yeah, the standard by which everybody else is now judged. And I don't think Reagan comes close to him, actually.
But what Reagan and Eisenhower have in common, as I've been told, and you can tell me if I got it wrong, is that each of them were able, apparently, to make the most terrific technical mistakes, if I can call it that, in their ways of presenting their case, their syntax. They can talk nonsense from time to time, and they'd not only be forgiven, but in some way the audience would warm to them almost for that.
Yeah, they're as bad as we are, for sure.
You see? So, quite clearly, when one says, is somebody good on the media or bad on the media, one's not just talking, is one, about the technique and the ability to string together a rational argument and to spit out one-liners or whatever it may be. One's also talking about something much more intangible, as I understand it, which is how you appear, just you taken all in all, warts and all, to the eavesdropping public. And I say eavesdropping because I've seen other evidence which suggests that the public only pays attention to television inadvertently. Not advertently, inadvertently. In other words, it's something which is just going on at the end of the room there, which they watch, say, for the sake of argument, 15 seconds out of 60 seconds, out of every 60 seconds.
But wouldn't you say with someone who's been in office that the media image is a small part of the reality that they convey, and that the major part of the reality has to do with people's performance, people's perception of their record, and that a media image out of sync with that becomes a problem, otherwise it doesn't. For example, Reagan was regarded as a tremendous, or was beginning to be regarded as a tremendous bungler in 1982 when the economy was going down. And people were saying he was living in a fantasy world. I think that his media performance would have continued to be regarded in that light, namely entirely negatively if the economy hadn't turned around. Mm. And his bungles, which are now sort of regarded as master strokes or whatnot, would have been seen as just that.
Yeah.
So, in other words, what I'm saying is that I think when you get beyond the first stages of a primary where someone, where all that you have is their media image,
yes.
but when you actually have a concrete series of decisions,
right.
records, and whatnot,
yeah.
and an experience with the person, that becomes far, far more important mm. in determining people's response than does their actual performance on television, which is then judged mm. and can only be judged in light of the reality of their performance.
Yes.
No, I think we really tremendously overestimate mm. For sitting presidents the mm. importance of media.
Mm.
I think a president can ignore the media mm. And if his record's good, mm. he'll come out all right.
Yes.
And I think presidents have made a mistake in thinking that the media is more important than it is.
Mm.
It's very important in primaries when they're running.
Mm.
Once they're in office, I think it's far, far less relevant than they think.
Mm.
And as bad a press as Carter got, I think if he did, with a couple of master strokes at the end, a successful Iranian hostage mission, he would have been in very good condition in 1980.
Mm.
And it was the record and not the media performance which did him in.
Mm.
I don't say it's irrelevant, but I think, you know, if President Reagan had actually judged him by the media evaluation in 1982, he'd be finished.
Well, all the modern presidents can't be wrong when they try to invest more and more and more time in cultivating the media and paying attention to that. But I believe your central point is correct, that it's often hard to separate out, unless you take a long historical view and look at other situations where what seems true today wasn't mm. true earlier. It's awfully hard to separate out the media impact from the impact of conditions on our events, on what is a thought of the president. And in good times, and you got a good president, or he's made some sort of victory, you know, that's my boy,
mm.
you know, and he looks good on television, and he's doesn't look tired, looks mm. rested, all those things. But bad news,
mm.
He's not going to look too good.
Mm.
And Reagan, I think is very good in some contexts, in the media, very bad in others.
Press conference, he's not.
He is not good at adversarial mm. television. That's why he avoids press conferences.
Mm.
That's why it was such a disaster on his first television debate with Mondale.
Mm.
He's not good at that. His training and his skills mm. as an actor are not in adversarial situations. Mm. When he is front and center stage.
Mm.
And they're not good when facts, he doesn't put in a good performance when facts are at issue.
Mm.
I remember very well his speech on the oceans of red ink and all this, you know, and he had been given all these statistics to read, and he was almost looking at his watch to see when is this going to be over,
mm.
and he was stretching rubber dollar bills and God knows
mm.
what, you know.
Mm.
That was not a credible performance.
Mm.
So he doesn't give those speeches anymore.
Mm.
I think another thing about Reagan is he has a good, he's his own public relations person.
Mm.
Most presidents aren't. And I would not be at all surprised after this presidency is over, we look back and we say, gee, he had far less exposure than his preceding presidents.
Mm.
He was far more selective about when he will be photographed.
Isn't that part of his secret? I mean, insofar as there is a secret in these media terms, I've been told by other people, sorry to interrupt him, that the very rationing of his appearances, which they do, and the selection of the right opportunities rather than the wrong ones is all part of the secret.
My favorite picture of Ronald Reagan, as I think should go down in the history books,
mm.
is he's saying bye-bye to the media.
Mm.
The reporters are shouting and
yes.
Reagan is...
Yes. Yes. As
going
he goes
to the
White House to helicopter. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
He puts distance between himself
yeah.
and situations in which he can't
intervene
in the media. That's very important. That
yeah.
gets him, I think, a lot of credit because he doesn't show his voice
mm.
on
on TV, so what does the press have to say about it? They can't constantly say he doesn't talk to us. I mean, they were saying that 3 years ago.
Yeah.
They can't say, well, you can't get some newspapers that way.
Yeah.
Could Carter have gotten away with that, do you think? The waving and just...
No, he's avoiding us because he's no good.
No.
But see, this is the point that I wanted to make earlier really about you, that, that I think Reagan is very good at lobbying the media. I think it's far less a change in the media than it is in his skill in the management of the media.
You mean doing it privately on the phone and so on? You mean that?
I mean in the way he manages the news. First year, Reagan's first year in office, you know what the press is going to do if you're smart. They're going to put Reagan, review of Reagan's first year in office, a second year, a third year. About 2 weeks before, 10 days, maybe a few days, before Reagan's, the press is going to say, you know, here's the good and the bad, here's the first year and so forth. Reagan appears saying, we've done an evaluation of our first year. And it sort of comes out the day of the end. So what are all the news stories? The news stories are, and the self-evaluation said we made some bad mistakes, we haven't fulfilled all of our promises.
Yes.
Carter did the same thing, but he didn't do it that way, which is important. He just said we didn't fulfill all of our promises.
Yeah.
So, you know, he's in trouble.
Yeah.
I think Reagan is very good at that kind of thing and manages that quite well.
Yes.
That the people who give out the grades on the president sort of day to day are being taught constantly by the White House what the president is good at, what this vote in Congress means, and so forth. That becomes sort of the storyline. I think he's very good at that. I think this is the big difference between him and Carter. Carter was good at press conferences, terrible at a mass audience television appearance.
Yeah.
Reagan is bad at press conferences, very good at the other.
Of course, it is true that I had a student this summer, this really floored me. This is the new interpretation. Reagan's been getting great press, and these students were maybe 17 or 18, so they're probably seen as the Reagan good press. And the argument was, well, obviously this is a conservative conspiracy because he pulls the strings at the Washington Post and the New York Times. Well, now I thought about that. I could see how a student might think that. But actually, if you look back over the first few years, he didn't have a good press early on. 1981, 82, and 83, they were the major media were trying to get him. They were as hard on him as they were on Carter. I can prove it to you. During the worst stage, the low point of the Reagan presidency, I have stacks of articles which says that the Reagan presidency has failed, the presidency is over, no modern president can succeed. And it was only when events were turned around that the press has turned around. And now I think they're sort of treating him gently because he's beaten them. I mean, he's beaten them at their own game. They tried to bring him down, and he succeeded in spite of that, and now they have no alternative but to say uncle. They'll criticize him a little bit gently, but they can't fundamentally go at his presidency.
I'm sure there was a time when they tried out various negatives on Reagan, that he's too old, or he's disengaged. They sort of invented all these reasons. None of them stuck with the public.
Right.
Terms of accomplishment, I collected, I think, every review after his first year, and from Hedrick Smith on down, it was all rated as a qualified success.
Right.
He got everything he wanted for him. So quite a change from Jimmy Carter, wasn't it?
That's true, but that maybe reflected the situation in 1981.
Oh, sure,
but when you get
sure it did.
When you get into 82 and 83, and he was vulnerable.
Recession,
nothing seemed to be going right. They were vicious with him.
And he was very low in the polls then, too.
He was extremely low in the polls.
As Michael Robinson told me the other day.
And, you know, at this point, they were vicious with him. So I don't think that, well, obviously these students, their image of Reagan in the press is a result of their experience in the last 2 years where it's been very favorable, but I don't think
I think the essential point is correct to find these things in bad times. It's going to be there's going to be criticism, but I think you've got to give Reagan credit for not for having something to do with it.
I do.
I think what he has to do with it is he knows when to avoid a public appearance.
Yeah.
And he knows how to run.
Yes. The difference I have is I agree that the media strategy is part of it, but I don't think that the media strategy is nearly as important as the actual condition of the country and the results of leadership. In other words, I think that the image is vastly, the images that can be made and manipulated through the media is vastly overrated.
But you made a distinction between an incumbent and a race.
Yeah, right, because in a race you don't have anything except your image. What do you have to sell? Most of these people who run for the presidency, they have something of their past, but especially in the early stages, they are selling that image in comparison to other people who are equally replaceable. I mean, why vote for Ronald Reagan in a primary when you can vote for someone who stands for about the same views, who has about the same experience? All you have to differentiate yourself from someone else is what you can portray during a campaign. But once you're a politician, you have the reality. Now, it's true that you're engaged in a process of trying to present that reality in its most favorable terms. And that extent, I agree with you completely. How you manage the news is extremely important. But it's not nearly as important as the reality itself, I would say. And that you can really turn things around if you can turn them around.
I think there's an area of press influence that doesn't really bear so much on the question of leadership that's much more powerful influence. And that is in the explanation of events. And in the making of meaning, not only the definition of news, but what does this mean that we're reporting? I'm surely not alone in being one of those professors who, whenever I come to my class to talk about anything current, I'm relying on what I've learned from the news, almost never from any other source. I consider myself fortunate when I have another source. That's a source of tremendous political education in terms of factual information and in terms of what it means. How does one interpret this? Mm. In 1962 or somewhere around there, one of my graduate students was going to do a thing on the Washington Press, and he got scared at the last minute and asked me to come and hold his hand while he was doing it. So he's doing interviews of all the wire service and the news bureau chiefs, probably the rest of them. Head of the New York Times Bureau then, and I went around with this tape recorder, spending an hour or two with all these people. It was quite interesting for me. And I remember when we called on Ben Bradley, who took more time talking than anybody else, he was sitting there as he was editor. He was sitting out there with a newsroom out, and he was telling us what the impact of television would be on his business and on politics. It's famous. Last words. He was sort of wrong about it all, I think. But he was saying the problem that television has taken away the scoop, as the print media can no longer be there first with the most. So they get their electronic media. So what the printed media now have to do is interpret, news analysis. So much news being fed to us, so many items. My daily problem is figuring out what to select out of all that we're being fed, but more than that, to explain to our readers what it means. That's the thing television can't do. Mm-hmm. Of course, it turns out that the national television are reading the New York Times and the Washington Post and building their programs around the headlines. So it didn't quite work out.
But in the meantime,
the importance of the explanation of all this confusing stuff that comes out of us. What does it mean when this is happening?
Sure, but it's almost always interpreted, it has been recently, in ways that are unfavorable to presidents. And it's for presidents
not
to...
Not always.
Okay. I say that from the president's point of view, he has to assume, it's not always this way, he has to assume that the interpretation of events as it's done through the media is going to try and be unfavorable. that's the reality that I think that a president faces. Now, that hasn't happened always. It certainly wasn't the case before Vietnam. But since Vietnam, any event is filtered in such a way as to try and somehow or other to incite and to get the president. No, it's for the president to make events so manifestly positive that the media can't do anything other than say they were successful.
No, I don't think the press is so presidentially obsessed as it used to be. I think there's plenty of news about what's going on in Congress. I don't even see Ronald Reagan's name mentioned except in the last paragraph. Other things that are going on, of which these are not necessarily presidential stories.
No, but anything that does have
they are explaining to people how their country is being governed and who's doing what to whom in Washington. And a lot of times they're really off base.
No, but for example,
bone to pick with you.
For example, the
notion that Jimmy Carter assigned the tennis courts is an apocryphal.
Yeah.
See? That's what you learned that in the press.
Yeah.
It's not true.
Not true. But why did that get in there in the first place?
Well, that's part of your problem, see, with the press. There's also myths become easily made.
Yeah.
Also, his energy speech did not say what you said it said, but that's what the press says.
Yeah. Well, that's bearing out your argument, isn't it? The people who
now, how many more things are there like
that's
that
very good.
Saying this is what he really means?
The people who prepare as meaning are in fact in a critical position.
I say these images stick because of the course of events. That is, if Carter was perceived as weak, it's because decisions did not convey strength.
And
it could have been changed.
No, I don't have any argument about that. I was just saying that there's a lot of
news
nowadays that is not particularly presidential, and there's a lot of news analysis that's not particularly presidential.
But I see where it involves the president.
Word about what's going on, internal stories in Nicaragua, for example, or other spots in the world. There's no necessary presidential news line in those stories, but it is an important source of public information.
Well,
about what's
let
going
me
on
ask
in
you
the
this:
world.
Do you think, for example, let me give you two examples. The interpretation to the American people of the Iranian hostage crisis, and also the interpretation of what's going on in South Africa. Implicit in most of the things I watch on television is some negative evaluation of the administration's policy. In other words, news about South Africa always seems to have what is the United States going to do about it and how the president isn't doing the right thing. And the same was true, I think, of the Iranian hostage situation. Every time a story appeared on Iran, it had something, in a way, negative connotations vis-a-vis President Jimmy Carter.
That's where I think, though, I've got a thesis that's a little different from either of you, and maybe it is, but that in a sense, Reagan's strength and the strength of perhaps Roosevelt in some somewhat similar situations was in neutralizing, at least temporarily, the criticism. I mean, if you look at Reagan's foreign policy record, compared to Carter's, it's very weak. But I mean, the substance of the record: there's no Panama Canal Treaty, there's no SALT II, there's half a dozen other things. Camp David meeting. Now, with every one of those policies, you can sit down and analyze them, and experts have, and show their insufficiency. But still, they were.
But they show an enormous effort on the part of the president to try to achieve something.
Sure, and when you talk to, when you listen to some of the people involved, whether they were the Vance people or the Brzezinski people, they had somewhat coherent explanations for them. But Reagan really has accomplished little or nothing, but he's neutralized the criticisms of people by your business of somehow getting on the wavelength. I mean, if it began to shift toward symmetry, he shifted. If it began to, you know, if it was time to get out of Lebanon, he got out of Lebanon.
So he's pragmatic to that extent. See, people have pointed out to me that he's nothing like so ideological or kind of rigid as some of his detractors portray.
And even Grenada and these other things, when criticism and the polls were against Nicaragua, something like Grenada comes along. and people are temporarily permanent.
I guess I disagree a little bit on the evaluation of his record. Mm. I mean, he did make the decision in Grenada. That kind of decision, a bold stroke, covers you in other situations. It did cover him in Lebanon, but he did make the decision in Grenada. He did order the bombing of Libya. I think those shows in foreign policy of strength are real events that people, and real decisions that people can identify with. And then when he, in other situations, he can rely on those as saying, well, here's my record. I don't think his record is quite as weak as...
Well, but you compare, for instance, either of those with Vietnam or Korea. I mean, in terms of sheer effort to use force, if that's the test.
Well, it has to be used well and effectively.
Yeah.
I mean, the problem in Vietnam is that the use of force didn't work out. If Lebanon had been the image of the Reagan presidency in the first term, it would have been a clear disaster.
But one surgical strike worked and Lebanon didn't work.
And that's why I said I think that Carter's presidency and many of the things that we remember about him, even at the last moment, remember the Iranian hostage raid was already in April. I think that if that had been a stunning success, combined with a few other things over the course of the summer, that all the things that we remember about him could have been reversed, that he really could have...
Yes, but the press would have also said he is recouped. He's now surging again. He's now Washington is all, you know, he's changed his image. So what's the chicken and what's the egg?
The chicken is the only thing that the president has under his own discretion, which are his actions. Because he can't control fully the news. That's out of his hands in our system.
That's right.
What he can control is
what he does.
What he does. Yeah.
Yeah. I think Kent's point is invalid.
About his record? Well, I don't know.
No. Well, quite apart from that, I think it's
Grenada is not a far place. It's hard to make the case that a tiny little place like that and a few hundred troops going in
a mortal threat
to the Western world. But still, he did it fast, and it seemed to neutralize the criticism.
I think what made Reagan's image, gave him a margin of maneuverability that Carter didn't, was the what he did at the PATCO strike. That was right near the beginning. Yeah. He fired him. Yeah. And he showed that he could be tough. I think Grenada fit in with that. It was the combination of those two. Sure, it was no big deal, but when you saw a president after supposedly the image of Carter was that he was weak and indecisive and couldn't do anything, this had an impact. True, a lot of it was public relations. These were no big deals, but he did it and he stuck to it and showed a kind of toughness.
Sure. That, almost zero risk.
Yeah, well, those are the ones to take.
Those are the ones to do.
That's what he's saying.
He only takes on the scraps. He never takes on any big enemy.
Compared to the Falklands, right? How would you compare the Falklands?
In all fairness, how many people wanted to let's take the foreign policy. How many people in the United States in high levels of government wanted to cashier the government of El Salvador in 1981 and 82. I can remember week after week where tremendous pressure was on the president to abandon the government and to pressure the government to making negotiations with the guerrillas. In effect, to abandon the government is absolutely and politically totally amoral. Mm. He didn't do it. The Contra issue certainly isn't the popular one. He's sticking with that. You could say that that's crazy. He's not always doing what's easy or popular in foreign policy. Certainly, South Africa is another instance. He may be completely wrong, but I don't think he's doing the thing that's easy or popular. And I think on that score, his position on the El Salvador case is a credit to him, if you regard it as a success. The pressure in Washington in 80 and 81 to abandon the government and simply go over to the side of the guerrillas was immense.
But he was lucky that Duarte came along. That's true.
He's been lucky. He was lucky in the Philippines.
The last person to climb aboard, I might say.
Yeah. No, and Haiti, he's been lucky. But
his own administration was having to lobby him in public
to
declare with the winner.
Yeah.
But the thing is, when you say that there have been instances where Reagan has gone against what seems to be the view of the time, and you give the example of South Africa, in fact, what it really is, isn't it, is the view of the informed minority. I mean, it may well be that they've got private polls done by Dick Wirtlin or somebody like that, which show that insofar as Joe Public takes any interest in these issues at all, they're actually not all gung-ho for sanctions and the rest of it. Is that possible?
My impression is that he's been very selective about resisting what is a clear indication of what plays in Peoria.
Mm.
And I think with a presidency of declining power, who's given far less license, I think, than in previous times, this is probably a prudent strategy.
Yes.
What it means in terms of the objective merits of the policies this leads to is debatable.
Mm.
I think South Africa is one. I think this issue has an importance for this biracial society that is not well perceived abroad, and that Reagan, not having been a member of any of the biracial, not having experienced it, may not himself fully perceive. It's not sanctions, it's declaring what side you're on.
Mm.
And he appears to be declaring on the side of the government, which is the losing side.
Yeah.
It's got to be. We've been through this.
Yeah.
I agree. Politically, he's spending a lot for who knows what.
That's right. It's very difficult to understand that, why he's doing it.
And I think your interpretation of how it plays in the United States is absolutely right.
If I could just say one thing that strikes me is the first time I've been to America is how positive people seem to have a view of Ronald Reagan in this country, whereas abroad he's considered, just a disaster.
It's a strange correlation
because in Europe, I talk about German people I know, French people I know, English people I know, he's considered, an absolute dreadful president, and he's done so much harm in foreign policy because things like the CND movement in Europe was virtually moribund. Had only a few cranks belonged to the anti-nuclear movement up until about 1979. It was a really minority thing. Now it is really big time. It's done so much. He's done so much harm in terms of the way he talks, his rhetoric. For any kind of Western alliance, and it's really it's been a terrible increase in this anti any kind of nuclear movement, and this has been growing, and lots of people who are anything but left wing are really very keen on CND now, which is really unthinkable before he started doing these things, and just about everything he's done in foreign policy has alienated a lot of really quite conservative Western European thoughts and people who are traditionally great supporters of the Western alliance. He's done a lot of harm, I think, in Western Europe. And things like the Libya thing was the latest thing, which is going to have a lot of repercussions, I think, in terms of if America wants to have bases in certain countries, it's going to be much more difficult in future. But that's just my uninformed.
It's
true. But I don't know if I'd accept that in France. I spend a lot of time in France. Now, he's immensely popular in France, and even the Libyan raid was popular.
Mm.
So it may depend on the. And there's no peace movement to speak of.
Mm, that's true.
In France.
In France, I mean.
Are you talking about what opinion?
Reagan is extremely popular.
Because that was my impression.
But not in
what we were hearing. That he was
maybe not in Britain.
Popular.
Yeah. But the difference with France is that they've got an independent nuclear deterrent, and I think that's very, very different. I think because we're, West Germany and Britain are in NATO, and we haven't got the independent nuclear thing. I think that the way in which Reagan sort of talks and also some things he's done has created a great well of anti-feeling, and it's not going to help the the alliance at all. And I think it's going to be quite a big election issue in Britain. You know, I don't think so. A lot of people are very worried about
it. If the government that had conducted the Falklands War in Britain had been a government to the left, and if the president and the United States government had helped the British as it did, would that have changed the situation completely? See, what I think has happened in Britain, the war was associated with the government of the right. This president of the right helped the prime minister of the right.
Yeah.
He didn't get any credit on the left for that, whereas he should have. I mean, he came to the aid of...
That's right.
The United States came to the aid, and there was a lot of pressure in this country not to do it.
Yeah.
And it never seemed to have made much impact with the British people.
Yeah. Well, I think the truth is that the British people, because of our secrecy, this is a separate subject, they didn't actually know just how much and how vital was the assistance that you all were giving to us to enable us to do it. And while the war was on, we weren't about to tell our own people that we were really critically dependent upon you. It's only really come out later. It's sort of leaked out gradually. That's the first thing. Second thing is that you're right. Reagan wasn't given much credit, even by informed opinion, once they discovered the battle was, for his decision that, yes, we must help the Brits to do this, that, and the other. Because I suppose in our sort of arrogance, the arrogance of informed opinion, that is, they thought, well, they damn well should, shouldn't they? Because, I mean, if it's a question of us against the Argies, well, they really ought to be on our side, which, of course, merely betrays the British ignorance about America's Latin American and Pacific and sort of Western destiny, which has always been drawing her, or tempting her to be drawn away that way, and to give priority to that rather than priority to us.
Well, I mean, the analogy, though, would be how Americans assumed, I think, the same thing, especially after the Falklands War, with respect to the Libya bombing raid. That
could you have given us air privileges again if we had another Libyan strike?
You mean if you asked the second time?
At the second time.
I would guess not, because Mrs. Thatcher, even Mrs. Thatcher, who clearly sees the realpolitik advantage of basically saying yes to President Reagan whenever she can, so that she can cash it in later for other things. But I think even Mrs. Thatcher, if I remember rightly, hearing her say it in the Commons, was very careful to say that the next request, if it comes, will have to be looked at on its merits. With the clear implication that I shall feel freer next time to say no. And reading between the lines, there was quite a lot of implication in what she said on the record that this was, in a sense, a payoff. We owed the Americans one, at least one. And you can argue as to whether the help we gave you over Libya was proportionate to the help you gave us over the Falklands, and I think it wasn't, actually. But I think she was prepared to pay her debts to that extent, as it were. But I think it's at least an open question whether she'd make a further payment if your president, not this one necessarily, but a future president, came to her and said, look, well, we accrued this amount of credit with you, you know, $100 worth of credit for what we did to you, with you over the Balkans, and you've only accrued, or you've only paid back $40 worth of that $100 on Libya, so we're still owed $60, therefore can we have some more, please?
Well, didn't we pay a little bit on South Africa? Could be just be Reagan's own viewpoint, but it could also have been that his statements had something to do with not leaving Margaret Thatcher simply out herself, because she came out with that, not only the first statement against sanctions, but the first sort of a moral defense of why it would be wrong. And Reagan said the same thing a couple weeks later.
Yeah. I don't know.
Sort of not leaving her isolated.
Yes.
But she had a very difficult time over the Grenada issue. Difficult time, because she sort of always said no, hadn't she? And then it all just happened. And of course that is very bad for the public image of, you know, the relationship between the two countries.
Yeah.
And it just plays into the hands of CND. Because, you know, I make this point because I know a lot of certainly not anything like left-wing people in Britain, you know, sort of the moderate conservative housewife with children, college educated, and the very last person you'd expect to join CND. They're paying up, and they're going to vote. They're going to vote the Labour Party because they don't like the way Mrs. Thatcher has this special relationship with Ronald Reagan, and they're going to vote against it. And I think it's going to be quite a big factor. And the number of people who are anything but the natural constituency for this kind of peace movement are just joining up. and paying up. You know, they actually became full paid up members.
One of the things you get into, I'm sure, is this interplay between domestic politics and national politics. Every TV show over the weekend and this morning had interviews with Seymour Hersh. Mm-hmm. And you know, it now becomes clear that either just before Reagan's statement on the AL shooting, or just after, we knew apparently through our own intelligence that the plane, if this thesis is borne out, that the plane was off course.
Really?
But for the president to have acknowledged that politically, whatever he might have felt as a pragmatist, mm-hmm. it seems to me the pragmatist and the practical politician, pragmatist in foreign policy and the practical politician play back and forth constantly with him. He couldn't have given up, I don't imagine, the advantage of this seeming to substantiate some of the things that have been said about the evil empire. Look what they did.
Well, wait, I haven't been following this. I know what happened. The plane was off course, but what is
it? It was shot down.
Right.
Reagan knew it, but still made the... Knew that the plane had been off course and that it had been shot down.
But was it on a spy mission? Or?
No, it wasn't on a spy mission.
I don't see how this changes the...
We could have rescued it.
What?
If we knew it, we could have...
Well, but did we do it deliberately, or was it just an oversight? Or I don't see why this changes the act that they took an unidentified aircraft and instead of attempting to force it down and discover what it was, shot it down. I don't see how this...
Well, but the original presentation was pretty much in terms of essentially a conspiratorial effort. The Russians may have coaxed it off course. It wasn't even clear that it was over their line, and you know, they waited for it to go a little bit over the line. We put not the absolute worst, but the nearly absolute worst.
Okay, I see what you're saying.
Course on it, and I'm saying that if Reagan did that, knowing that he himself would then take moderate action, as he did, he didn't do the things that the far right wanted him to do. Why he did it? Because he had to deal with the Helms Wing. Mm-hmm. Any more than he, for instance, he failed to support Schultz when Schultz complained about the 22 ambassadors who made statements supporting Helms' re-election.
Yeah, I see.
You know, he has to deal with his right, just as the Democrats have to deal with their left, however pragmatic they are. And that enters in, it seems to me, set some limits and constraints on...
I haven't read the Hersh, but it sounds to me like they're going to try and make the KL look like it was our fault rather than the Russians. I want to follow this.
I haven't read it either, but as I understand it, it's the failure to give the plane warning. Yeah. Isn't that it? That we knew that it was off course, but we would compromise.
Yeah, well, the really Machiavellian interpretation is that they're quite happy to allow these people to go to their death, even though they knew they could prevent it. Because then that would be evidence which could be used graphically to say, look, that's the nature of the evil empire. They shoot down innocent...
How could we have known that they would have shot it down as opposed to force it down?
This is going to
be like the Cambodia, the Shawcross thesis of Cambodia, that this thing happened, and there were certain things we didn't do, but the things we didn't do transformed.
You can't prove cause and effect, can you?
Right.
Well, I think, Professor, I must thank you very much. That's we ought to move on. Because I'm sure you're all very busy too.
We'll call.
We'd love to go around there and have a look.
Was
there a person there?
Yeah, we